last week we happened to pass, I did a little bit of a research. In our Gemara it said, Sar Afis. The Gemara had said that most everybody held that a Sar, what was it? The Gemara had said, the Gemara has had a problem, that the statements of Rav Sheshes went back and forth. When he spoke about, he said, Kol ha-mazalos were mutarim, so except for the ma'asol chama levana, all the parts sufim are mutarim, except for the parts of Adam, and all the tsuros are mutaros, except for the tsuros darkon. So the Gemara pointed out that the first and third lines were not necessarily were about defining them, not about making them. And the middle part about all the parts of Mutarim except for parts of Adam was actually about the prohibition of making it, not the prohibition of finding it. If you find it, it wouldn't necessarily be a problem. If you find the parts of Adam, so that you don't assume that it was worship. So the problem is that Rav Sheshes was going back and forth on Mbezim and Beis. So Abaye said, yeah. Abaye said that the first and third statements referred to finding, and the middle statement referred to making. So Rava didn't like that, because Rava would have preferred that everything be consistent. So Rava said that there are a few faces that if you find them, they're also. And he mentioned this term, Sar Afis. In Rabbeinu Hananel, it's actually printed as one word, and there is actually pretty, this was easy to find. A seraphis is in fact an image that you find in among Greco-Roman statues. It seemed to have been a cross between Greco-Roman and Egyptian god. It kind of looks like, you know, an Egyptian headdress. It's the kind of thing that, like, you watch the Ten Commandments, you'd expect, like, Moses to be wearing or something like that, or Pharaoh to be wearing. And so the idea that it's associated somehow with Yosef is actually not crazy. Yosef is the viceroy of Egypt, so I could see how the Gemara connects the two. It was harder, the closest association I can find for the second one, the Mimika, might be Isis, not the movement, the contemporary movement, actually the cult of Isis. It was a female goddess of fertility and various fertility, childbearing, nursing, whatever have you. So sometimes you can find some images of this of the goddess holding a child, nursing. So that's presumably what these are references to. Okay. Anyway, the last thing we had looked at was on Mem Gimel Amid Aleph, which was about 10 lines down, Tana Rabbanon, Ezu Tzuris Darkon, and we spoke about, if you can also look online, you know, do Wikipedia, do a Google search for dragon gods and look at images, and you'll see a lot of them that have kind of the scales near its neck. All right, so that was what the Gemara ended with, Halachak Rav Shimon Elazar. So now, we're about, after the two dots, we're about three lines down at the end of the line. Amar Rabba Bar Chana, Amar Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi. Pamachas hayisi mahalach acha Rabbi Eliezer hakapar beribi. One time I was walking after Elazar hakapar the great, baderach. We're traveling on the way. Umatza sham tabas. He found a ring. Probably was a ring, maybe out of gold or something very valuable. And valatzur es darkon. And it had the image of a dragon on it. So here's the problem. The problem is that since it has the image of a dragon on it, one assumes that it in fact was Nevada, it was worshipped. So what are you going to do? Well, if Rabbi Elazar HaKapar picks it up, so then the game is over, because as soon as he picks it up, he makes a kinyan on it. It's now Avod Zarah Shel Yisrael, and Avod Zarah Shel Yisrael has no bittul. So this is a little bit like the guy, you know, finds something very expensive on Shabbos, but his muxus, he decides to wait till Shabbos till afterwards. So here, it's not Shabbos, but instead, he's waiting for something else. What is he waiting for? So matza oved kochavim katan. A oved kochavim is a katan, very young, not such a bucky in other words, passes by, velo amar lo klum, doesn't say anything. You know, a katan passes by, he doesn't take the opportunity to do anything, to ask the katan anything. Then, matza oved kochavim gadol. And then he found an oved kochavim, in fact, was of majority, was of a sound mind. Va'amar lo batla, and he said, be mevatel that thing for me. Velo bitla, he refused to do it. Sitaro, he smacked him on the face and said, batla, ubitla. And then he was mevatalith. That's the story. Okay, it's not, it's kind of interesting they choose to tell the story. If I were writing Tales of the Rabbis, I think I would probably edit this one out, or I would change the version slightly, whatever. So the Gemara says, Shmamina, number one, Obed Kochavim Mavatal Ovoz Kochavim Shalov Shochavera. First thing that you can see from the story is that an Obed Kochavim can be Mavatal Ovoz Zara, not only if it belongs to him, but even if it belongs to a different Obed Ovoz Zara. So that's the first one. Ushmamina, by the way, in just as a general rule, when the Gemara has Shmamina Tlas, I'm not sure that I would say in this case it is a problem, but three was a very popular number. As a general rule, I'm willing to bet you if you do a survey of all the Shmaminas in Shas, Shmamina with a number, you'll find there's one Shmamina Tmanya, there's one with her eight, that's an Arvei Psachim. But outside of that, it's pretty much always three, and then occasionally it's two, maybe another number, but it's almost always three. They like the number three, and because of that, sometimes when you get a Shmamina Tlas, it looks like one of them may be a little bit forced, because they wanted to say Shmamina Tlas. It's like, I don't know, I think I figure this out intuitively, but I think Rabbi Lichtenstein always teaches this, and homiletics is that everything should come in threes, right? Somehow we like that number. I don't know what it is. So this case, I think all three seem to be relatively compelling. So Shmamina, the first one, Obe Kochavim can be mivatel his avodah zara and someone else's. Ushmamina yodeya b'tiv shel avodas kochavim misham sheha mivatel b'she'eni yodeya b'tiv avodas kochavim misham sheha eino mivatel. In order to be mivatel avodah zara for a guy, he has to understand what avodah zara is. If he's too young or not of sound mind, where he doesn't understand the theology at all, then he is not capable of doing so. Which, by the way, raises a very interesting question. What about someone who's not an Obed avodah zara? What about someone who's a Ger Toshav? Can he be Mevatel Avodah Zarah? He's not Jewish on the one hand, and on the other hand, he's not an Obed Avodah Zarah. So actually, interestingly enough, I forgot it already, because I think it was in the Daf Yomi Bav Metzia, but fortunately for me, the Rif actually cites the Gemara on this Amud in the Rif, so we'll take a look at that. But can a Ger Toshav, who's not an Obed Avodah Zarah, can he be Mevatel Avodah Zarah? Is he in this respect like a Jew or like a Goy? And finally, the last line is Ushmamina Oved Kochavim Mevatel Baal Karcho. And Oved Kochavim can be Mevatel and Avodah Zarah even if he's forced to do so. Now, if it's done under duress, so it's considered valid. This is a larger kind of question in terms of actions and coercion. We, I think, tend to look at a coerced action as inherently invalid. That doesn't seem to be necessarily the view that Chazal generally take. There is a sugya in Bava Basra, Talyua v'zabin, zabine zvine. If a person, if someone puts a gun to your head and says, sell me your house, and he pays you full price for the house, and you agree to sell the house to him under duress, so the halacha says that the sale is valid. It's not mutter for him to do that, but the assumption is that agav zuze gama ramakne, between the threat between wanting to preserve his life and the fact that you're paying him full value, he decides to go ahead and be makne with Lev Shalem. Whereas the Gemara says, tell you of a yayiv, if they put a gun to your head and say, give it to me, and you give it to him, so the halacha is it's an invalid matana, because there's no compensation being given. In the very same way, the Gemara says, interestingly enough, that Talyua v'kaddish, if a man puts a gun to a woman's head as mekaddishar, so alpi din Torah, the kiddushin are binding, because she is getting something in exchange for that. Now, that's obviously a very bad public policy, and the Chachamim thought that as well, and that's why the Gemara there invokes the principle of hu asa shaloka hogen, lefikach hu him asu lo shaloka hogen. He did act improperly, therefore they treated him in kind. The Chachamim dissolved those Kiddushin on the spot. So I'm not, the last particular one puzzles me a little bit for any number of reasons, but I think there's a general principle, the notion of coercion is not something that the halacha automatically regards as invalid. If you think perhaps of one of the most famous cases, one of my two favorite Rambams in psychology, one we did earlier a few years ago with Livnei Iver, and this is the much more famous one, the Rambam in 220 of Hilchos Gittin, where the Rambam says, you know, the Gemara Kiddushin says that if a person doesn't want to be Mekadesh, Megarish's wife, so Kofan Osachi Umarotzani. So the Gemara says, Yochal Bal Karcho Tamalomar, in another context, Lirtzono, it has to be, it's consent. So what do you mean? You put it, you know, I don't want to give my forget. You beat him once, okay, with a rod. I don't want to give my forget. You beat him twice. Finally, it's starting to hurt, so he says, okay, I'll give my wife forget. What he really wants to give his wife forget, so the Rambam says that basically people want to do the right thing. But however, what happens is that the Yetzer Hara gets in their way. And the Yetzer Hara, you might call the pleasure principle that governs them. In this case, their sadism towards their soon-to-be ex-wife. And therefore, the halacha says that we introduce pain into the equation. And then when the Yetzer has to consider the entire calculus of the pleasure they get of the sadistic behavior against the physical pain of the rod, so you know what? They really do. In other words, when he finally says, I want to do it, he really does want to do it. Obviously, he's conflicted, but in the net sum, the total calculus, he wants to do it. So here the Gemara says that if you force a guy to be mevatel your avodah zarah, so then it is considered a valid bittul. The interesting question is that when you look in most of the other cases of kfiya, of coercion, so there usually is some compensating factor, right? In other words, there, if you force a guy to give to sell you his land, but you're compensating him, so we understand there's the compensation. By the get, we understand there's the mitzvah. The person really wants to do the right thing, and the right thing is to divorce his wife, and now we want to make sure that he sort of gets to that particular stage. But in this particular case, it's an interesting question. Why does the kfiya work? And the answer might, I mean, there's a larger question. I don't think the Gemara addresses this. Is there a mitzvah to be mevatel avodah zarah? So it might be, the answer is yes, it could be. There is a mitzvah in Eretz Yisrael, certainly, to tear out avodah zarah, to destroy it. And if a Jew happens to come into possession of avodah zarah, let's say in Chutz Laretz, there's also a mitzvah to destroy it. So it could be that bittul is not actually physically destroying it, but bittul is the equivalent. That the whole idea is to remove avodah zarah from this world, so it increases the presence of God's presence in the world. So then maybe, in fact, there is a quasi-mitzvah involved. So therefore, when you're kofa the goy to do this, so then, in fact, you are being kofa in some strange sense on a mitzvah. All right, that's what the Gemara says. Marshall?
How can one goy mevatel avodah zarah if 10 other people are still worshipping the same thing?
So I don't think he can, but in this case, remember that the ring was lost. Somebody lost the ring, so it's gone. So right now, nobody's worshipping it. So he's coming along, and you don't want to pick it up, but he comes along, and you say, listen, b'mavathal avodah zarah. So yes, if some other guy were to come along right now, while it's still ownerless, and worship it after he was mavathal it, it would once again be an avodah zarah. But that's not the reality. So, Marshall?
Why don't you just assume I guess I'm confused by your comfort and halacha's comfort with the first of the three cases of kfiya, with paying, quote, full value for the house.
Right.
First of all, that assumes that there is such a thing as objective full value. Second of all, very often, especially with something like a house, then the value to the owner is very different than the market price, and I think very few of us would move for, quote, full value for our homes. Why would you build a halakhic system in this attribute of allowing any coercive transactions at the point of a gun to ever be validated?
I think it's a fair question. The Gemara's case, but I don't think it matters as a sadem, but I don't think it makes a difference. I don't think we usually distinguish between items. Just to answer to the first, I can't answer the second part of the question. There's a principle, dvarim shebelev enam dvarim. The first part of the question was full value. There is a certain value. In other words, people sell houses all the time. Not everybody wants to sell a house. So obviously, if you asked me, if you gave me X dollars, would I sell my house to you today? The answer is no. You know, but if you offer me $5 million for my house, the odds are my wife and I would probably say yes, and we just go buy another house, right?
That's not market price. That's not the example.
I agree, but the point is that everybody, I think, there is a certain cost. There's a premium, granted, but bottom line is people do sell houses. They sell houses for various reasons. Let me add another complicating factor in here. There is a concept. I think when I spoke about lifnei mishur hadin, I think this came up. I left out that case. That case is not on the source sheet. Let's say a person owes money and they can't get the cash together, and instead they're forced to sell their field to raise the money. So the question is, and then or 2 weeks later they get money. Can they now force you to sell the field back to them? Now to us that seems very strange. But there is a machlokas in the Gemara. Some say that if you sold your field because of dochak, right, because you needed the cash, that you can turn around and buy it back. And others say it's only lifnei mishur hadin that you have to sell it back to the person. So what's the svara behind the person who sells, who says that you can force him to sell the field back? So the answer is that he's basically saying the person only sold the field because of onus. They were forced to. If you sell, the Gemara's contrast is mocher sadeh mitnei ra'asa. If I sell a field because it's not a very good field, so I'm happy to get it off my hands and you give me cash. So there is a notion the Gemara is working with that people only sell things. We're not talking about someone who's in business, who buying and selling, but people only sell things in most cases, and unless it's mocher sadeh me'asa, because of duress in the first place, and yet the sale is considered valid. I think this is, point is explicitly connected. So I think that we may live in something of a different world. If you think about, the way, you know, when we sell things, we tend to think people, both parties walk away with something. But if you think about Yechezkel's depiction about the oncoming destructions, and he says, Hakoneh al yismach, v'hamocher al yisabol. Right, the buyer shouldn't rejoice, and the seller shouldn't be sad, shouldn't mourn, because you're all being exiled, you're all losing everything. So there was no great loss in all. I think it does speak to a slightly different way of things than I think that we may look at it. So
I'll let it go, but I would say this. Your two examples both cut the wrong way. They show that there's an assumption that the connection to karka is fundamentally different than it is today. And so that's why the base assumption is that any seller of land is despairing, any buyer of land is rejoicing, and even if it's,
and nonetheless the sale is valid.
The loss of karka is such a fundamental event in an agrarian society that it might even be reversible, even if it appeared to be a free will. The first case says you have no willingness at all to sell it. You have a gun to your head,
no,
but it's valid.
No, so let me just make the connection between them. The connection between the two is, I know this is sort of seems counterintuitive, but that in general, when a sale is valid, almost all sales are under duress, and yet they're, you know, if I sell my field because I need to raise cash, and now, so I might be allowed to turn around and buy it later. Let me take the sheet that it says I can't force you to sell it back to me, right? Why did I sell it in the first place? I sold it because of duress, and yet it's still valid, right? I can't force you to sell it back.
Not real honest.
What's that?
It's not halachically honest. That's not part of it.
Well, but I think if you look, the Gemara actually says this. I'm not, and this is not my sort of, you know, interpretation. The Gemara says that you. I think the Gemara might say in Bava Basra in that sugya of Tayu v'Zabin that's why people sell things. It's always under duress and it's still valid. So, well, as long as you receive compensation.
If you put a gun against my head and I sell it and it's valid, can I then force you to sell it back to me?
I mean, it would be valid as well. There we would.
So
Marshall, I suspect. I hear the. I am bothered by the other question. In other words, why is it that Chazal didn't think they made a takana by Kiddushei Isha? Right there, they saw the need to dissolve the Kiddushim. Why didn't they? They could have used more easily Hefker Bez and Hefker to dissolve the Kinyan. I don't know why. I suspect that part of it is, you know, part of it is that they are uncomfortable with Dvarim Shebelev. And as we have a principle, that Dvarim Shebelev, things that are not explicitly articulated, unless it's obvious to every single person, Dvarim Shebelev, Bablev, Kaladam, it is not a valid tonight, it's not a valid stipulation. So the Gemara's assumption is when I put a gun to your head and force you to give me the land, everybody knows you don't really mean, under no circumstances you're just going to give your land away for free. And by the way, that's not fully true. I'll give you the one exception to that. But if I'm selling, if I'm giving you full value for the land, so the Gemara says, Akav Zuzev Ones, Onse, Gamar Makne. Between the Zuze and the Ones, I decide to be Makne. The Mishnah in Gittin of Kamsa, the Kamsa Bar Kamsa Mishnah on Dafan Nunhamid Beis, I think, speaks about the rules of the Sikrikon. This was during the destruction period, and when Jews were selling their land to, let's say, an Anas, who you know, or giving their land to an Anas and to save their lives. And the Gemara assumes that at a certain stage of the Takana, where, I don't remember, I think it's the stage where the guy himself, who didn't kill you, could get in a lot of trouble for that you were genuinely gomer amakna to the person. It really was an exchange for your life. Which in itself suggests that part of the issue is when I put a gun to your head is you sell it, even though you're not really sure I'm going to actually kill you. So I'm paying you and probably I wouldn't kill you anyway, so therefore you're choosing to sell voluntarily. Whereas by the Sikrikon at a certain stage, if the Sikrikon takes your field, he would have killed you otherwise. So again, I think it's different. I agree with you that in terms of you wouldn't want to create a society that can operate in people buying under duress. I don't know how typical it actually was, but I think Chazal were sort of troubled about defining that line of where do you cross from, you know, every sale to some extent, except for Mochasad the Meirasa, is under duress, and where do you draw that line? And I think that they thought that only Talyuha V'yahiv, when he forces him and he gives it away without compensation, that's already considered Dvarim Shebeliba over Leif Kaladam, and it's understood it's an invalid kinyan.
No.
Okay. So anyway, yes.
Aren't you in... he hit the Akum and he got him to Mevatel the Avodah Zarah. Isn't that really... you're empowering the Akum now. Instead of... You're saying that his system has some validity. You know, wouldn't it be better just to treat it as a nothing item? By you treating it as a vodah zarah, as like you're giving the Akum the power to make this taboo or to take away the taboo. Why give the Akum? Wouldn't you not want to give the idolater that kind of power? Wouldn't it? And it's like you're saying that we have a system and they have a system. It's that their system is wrong, our system is right. But why would you even want to acknowledge that that they have a system? Why not? It's just the whole thing is just, you know, it's childish and made up.
Look, let's say you had a doctor who was not a very good doctor, right? But he had the power to prescribe. Mm-hmm. So you might nudge him to write a prescription for you, right? He's a lousy doctor, but so he's part of. Why can he do it? Because he's part of the system. He's part of the medical system, so he can prescribe.
No, but there is no system here. No, but there is a medical. You're saying that there is a medical system, but there should be. You don't want to say that there's a vodah zarah system. You want to say that it's the whole thing. It doesn't begin. It doesn't. It's no starter.
So there's a system. There's a broad system of theology, but apparently some parts of it are no good and some parts of it are good. And so I hear the question, but I don't know. I don't think Chazal thought in terms of these terms of empowerment. I think the bottom line is that someone the point is that a goy in general, a goy, someone who is part of this particular system in Avodah Zarah has the power. And the question
but
is not.
You want to show them that what you're doing is your whole system is nothing. Why you saying I can't touch this until you like do something that's going to have some validity? Don't you want to show them that it's just treated as nothing.
Listen,
part of our system is rejecting their system. That's very, a very big.
But why even? How about our system saying that their system is no system? How about saying that their system is no system? How about saying that their system is no system? That it's just an ordinary. You know, you made up some words and you changed this into an idol. Says who? This is nothing. It's like a child at the table who says, "I can't eat." You know, like everything green on the table is not edible, and the parents go along with it and say, "Johnny, you know, you have to like say that it's now edible." Because I can't eat it because you just told me that it's not edible.
So you're asking a broader question, not about this case. Is why is there such a thing as bittul for Avodah Zarah? Right.
No, why should they even be Avodah Zarah? Why even dignify Avodah Zarah?
So you want to ask why Avodah Zarah should even be Asur B'Hana? Why even recognize it?
Why recognize the system? You're giving it so much power. You're saying, you know, I can't pick this up because until you say that this is not taboo, it's taboo to me also, and I can't pick it up. Why give them? Why honor the idolatry?
That is a question I think I can answer, which is. Yeah. You know, that we might call it the taboo of disgust, or the morality of disgust, which is that this is a horrendous act. We find this all over the halacha. In other words, a horrendous act done to an object defiles it. That's the whole concept. Let's start with the first case. Why is Avodah Zarah Asur B'Hana? The answer is that there's an element of disgust here, right? Here you have an object which has been defiled, and therefore people should keep their distance for it. The real question, which I can't answer, I have some thoughts, but I don't want to share them now because I haven't had the chance to digest them, is why is there such a thing as bittul for Avodah Zarah? And interestingly enough, in this regard, this I will tell you the following. We're going to see a Mishnah later in the Masechta. There's two versions of the Mishnah. One is actually still printed in the Yerushalmi, and one is printed in the Bavli. According to the Bavli, they don't see the Yerushalmi. The Bavli says that Rebbe taught the Mishnah one way when he was younger, and he changed his mind when he was older. It happens to be the Yerushalmi prints the younger version of Rebbe, and the Bavli prints the later version of Rebbe. In the earlier version, a Jew could be Mevatel Avodah Zarah Shel Goy, I think. And a goy could be mevatel avodah zarah shel Yisrael and shel nachri. And later they changed that only a goy can be mevatel avodah zarah shel goy. So there seems to be a shift away, and one might argue that what's going on there is that they decided that the notion of bittul for avodah zarah, once it's been defiled, when a Jew has worshipped avodah zarah, it's totally out of the question, right? And the fact that a Jew cannot be mevatel, it means that the Jew has no connection to the system at all. It's a starting point, but it's a good question. Okay.
Also, just hitting him, coming to blows.
I
have to read that. You know, when you read this, we're reading in an age of ISIS. We can't get away from it. But look, we have to be honest. When we read this Gemara, we're reading it in an age of ISIS, and we just can't believe that
I said I would have chosen not to print this Gemara if I were the editor.
No, they needed it. They needed that because he said one of the things you learn is that this Baal Korcho, it's valid.
I know. I understand that. I understand. But it's a story that does make us uncomfortable for a reason.
By the way, I found that, you know, I just couldn't. Rav Lazar Kapper and Derech Erzut, I found. Did you know that he said that about idolatry? There's a pasuk in Hoshea, Chavur Atzavim,
Ephraim Hanachlo.
So he said that that Kivayachol, the divine presence, can't touch it. Israel, even if they're Obed Avodah Zarah, if they're Chavur, when they're together in peace.
Okay, that's
so, yeah, so it's interesting. So here the one who's so Makpid about Avodah Zarah is saying that God can't touch Jews if they're united.
Well, okay, fine. Anyway. All right, so now the Gemara goes on and has a different question about Rav Lazar Kapar. The Gemara says, "Megadev bar Rab Chanina." Rab Chanina was very upset at the story, not for the reasons we might be uncomfortable with the story. Megadev bar Rab Chanina. Velesle the Rab Lazar Kapar Baribi Hadatnan Hamatzel Min Ha'ari Umin Hadov Umin Hanomer Umin Hagayas. If a person saves an object, it could be an animal, whatever it is, they save it from the grasp of a lion or a bear or a leopard or a Gaius is a raiding band. Umin Hanar, off the river, had swept it away. Umizuto shel yam. The way Rashi describes it, but doesn't really fit. It almost sounds like a tsunami, where Rashi says where the water rushes inland a great, great distance. Now, it sounds like a tide, except for Rashi gives a distance of, you know, kama parsaos. So the best I can tell, when you look at high tides and low tides in most places, it might be 15 feet, 20 feet, 30 feet, 40 feet, not thousands and thousands of feet on a regular basis. But whatever it is, it's some place that the sea sometimes covers, the zuto shayam, umishluliso shonahar, which is literally the shalal of the river. It means the stuff that the river rises on its banks and sweeps something away. Vahamotse bisrate uplache gadola. If you find it on the highway or in a major marketplace, if you find an object in that place, you're allowed to keep the object. Why? Because the assumption is that the owners had Yeush. Why? Because they assume they're never going to get it back. So the question is, why did Rabbi Lazar HaKapar need to have Bittul here? After all, the guy knew he lost this ring, and presumably he's Miyayish from it, and therefore it is Batel Memela. Now remember, this is not an Avodah Zarah which is broken. It's not an Avodah Zarah Shenishtabra Meila. There's a different issue. It's an Avodah Zarah that's perfectly intact, but the guy knows that he lost it, and presumably in Habyeirsh. So the Gemara gives the following answer. The Gemara says, nah. He says, Amar Abaye, Nehidimi na Miyayish. The guy gives up on his own getting it back, but Meisura Mi Miyayish? He doesn't necessarily assume that it will no longer. He's not Mavatal, but why not? Because Meimar Amar, he says the following, Eoved Kochava Mashkachla, Miflach Palachla. He says maybe another guy will find it and he'll make it his deity. Not a problem. And Yisra Mashkachla, if a Jew finds it, Aidi, he obviously didn't understand that all Jews were very firm and would never do such a thing. Aidi, the Dameh Yikarim, because it's very valuable, a Mizabe Nala of Kochava Palachla. Right? In other words, the Jew will say, listen, let me sell this to a guy, he's an Oved of the Zara. So he would violate two Yisraim. Number one, he'd violate the Yisr of Hana, because when the Jew picks it up, it's still an Avodah Zarah, and he's not allowed to be Nana. Nobody can be Nana at that point. And number two, even putting that aside, even if it weren't yet an Avodah Zarah, to sell something to a guy that you know he's going to worship as an Avodah Zarah, so we learn the first mission in the Masechta that that's also, that's a violation of Lifnei Iver Lo Sitei Michshol, of enabling somebody else to sin. So therefore, obviously this guy, you know, he has a mistaken impression, because no Jew, Chas v'Shalom, would ever do such a thing, but he thinks that they would. So number one, he says, look, if a guy finds it, he'll worship it. If a Jew finds it, he'll get it to a guy to worship it. So it will still be a deity, just not, it's not going to be my deity. So in effect, he gives up on the mamonos, he gives up on the monetary aspects of it, but he doesn't give up on the it's Avodah Zarah status. He is not mevatalid, and that's why Rabbi Lazar HaKapar required some non-Jew in order to be mevatal the rate. Okay, so that's where the Gemara leaves really our Mishnah. And now the Gemara opens up something which is a very, very practical issue. It plays a role in Yeshiva University history, not a one that's been written up or published, but it's kind of a couple of incidents that I remember, one from a long time ago. I don't think it's there anymore, but when they opened this ISIM school of business, the school is there, but they had a bust of Mr. Sims, may he rest in peace, that sat on the fourth floor. And it was a complete bust, and it had a face, and it was, I don't know how lifelike it was, I don't think I ever met him, but nonetheless, it was a detailed face with all the features. And some raised an issue that that's a problem, according to the Shulchan Aruch. The second, that's not as shocking, and obviously nobody was worshiping, but we understand that. I mean, some people do worship the god of Mammon, I know that, but nonetheless, nobody was worshiping that bust, okay? Fine. But the second incident was more recent, and it was I'd done very, very quietly, and I wasn't surprised. which was that in the lobby of the library, there is now a large mural. But if you actually took a picture of the mural last year, so you would have seen that it looks different than it does this year. Because last year there was, you know, there was a sun and a moon and some stars on there. And this year, you wouldn't realize if you hadn't paid attention that the mural had been changed, but the mural was changed, and those no longer appear in it. So that's really emerges from this particular sugya. And it's interesting, whatever, we'll talk about some of the details. But this is a somewhat complicated sugya, but this deals with the issue of images and what forms may be made and what forms may not be made. We are, I would say Judaism is a little bit anti- anti-iconic, but not completely. In other words, we are probably much more open to music and literature from a halachic perspective than we are to art, for the reasons that are obvious, which is images of one kind or another, once upon a time, were worshipped. And therefore, the Torah prohibits not only the worshipping of idols, but even the making of idols. So that's what the Gemara is going to discuss. Now, the center around which the sugya is going to revolve is a pasuk that we spoke about last week, which was Lo Sasun Iti and Lo Echasa Velo Hezahav Lo Sasu Lachem. The simple reading of the pasuk, as we pointed out, was simply, you shall not make with me, in my presence, you shall not make gods of silver, and gods of gold you shall not make for you. We also mentioned last week that the Bali Masorah chose to place the trup in a funny place to incorporate the interpretation of the sugya, which is lo sasun iti, semicolon, you shall not make that which is with me. And on top of that, gods of silver and gods of gold you shall not make for yourself. Now, what exactly is with God? So, if we can even speak in such terms, in such anthropomorphic terms, so the Gemara will assume that there's a Madar HaElyonim and a Madar HaTachtonim, the upper dwelling place and the lower dwelling place. Now, elsewhere the Gemara assumes there are seven heavens, but here we deal just with two. And the Madar HaTachton has the luminaries. It has the sun, the moon, the stars, the planets. The upper echelons, the upper heavens, have the Kisei HaKavod. What was on the Kisei HaKavod? So the Merkava, the throne or the chariot, had on it various kinds of angels, whatever they look like. It had ofanim and things like that, srafim and ofanim, and then there were images engraved on around the chariot. There were four or the faces of the angels. There were four faces. There was the Nesher, there was the Aryeh, there was the Krov, and there was the Adam. If I got it right, there was the griffin vulture, the lion, the Krov, whatever a Krov is exactly, literally a cherub, whatever a cherub is, and a person. Those were the four faces that were there. And so those are basically, that's the sum total of the heavenly parts, the Madar Ayonim and the Madar HaTachtonim. And don't forget the rainbow, but no, they don't talk about making an image of a rainbow for whatever reason. Okay. So the Gemara says the following. Rabbi Gamliel was the Nasi, and he was in charge of Kiddush HaChodesh, of sanctifying the new moon, declaring the new month. And that, for a time at least, depended upon the testimony of eyewitnesses who had seen the moon. So, of course, there was a lot of controversy around this in terms of the desires of the Sadducees to mess up the calendar and all sorts of things, and also the desire for accuracy. So witnesses would come, but many people were not experts in astronomy. I suspect the average person once upon a time knew a whole lot more, practically speaking, about what the skies looked like than we do today. Today, we can't see most of what's in the sky because of light pollution, and we can see the moon, though, and most of us don't pay a whole lot of attention to the moon because we just look at our watches, we look at the calendar, and that's the end of the discussion. But in a world in which everything, when you didn't have printed calendars, and the calendar depended upon the moon, people paid a whole lot more attention. But nonetheless, not everybody was sufficiently expert, and so Rabban Gamliel had to interrogate the witnesses. And the Mishnah says the following: Tanan Hasam, Demus Tsuros Levanos, Hayulo Rabban Gamliel Ba'aliyaso Betavla Bakosel. Rabban Gamliel had tablets with images of the moon, meaning various phases of the moon, positions of the moon. Shebohen mare es ha-hedyotos. He would show it to the hedyotos, the commoners who saw something but, you know, needed help describing what they saw. V'omar lohem kazera isem o kazera isem. Right? A picture is worth a thousand words. This is a notion that is very much firmly entrenched in the halacha. It took me, I only realized this a few years ago. I'll pose the question the following way. What is a more accurate way of returning a lost object to a person? A siman, when he describes a particular feature of the object, or tvias ayin, when he looks at the object and says, that's the object, that's mine. Which is a more accurate way of determining whether it's his object? So those who study Bava Metzia know that the siman is considered more appropriate. Why? Well, the answer is it's not because it's more accurate, it's because of trust. In other words, a tvias ayin, it depends upon the person looking at the object and saying, that's mine. Once the person does that, they say it's mine, how do you know that they're lying or not lying? If a person has to give a siman, he has to give a feature of the object, the corner of the box was chipped or something like that, he cannot know that, and if he identifies that, you would say, obviously it's his object, because otherwise how would he know that? So it's true that from the perspective of lying, from the perspective of telling the truth or lying, a siman is more useful than tfias ayin. But that's only because by a siman, you don't show the person the object. Tfias ayin, you have to show it to them, and he just says yes or no. Mm-hmm. But in terms of general reliability, assuming that no one is lying, it is clear from the Gemara Yevamos that tfias ayin is much, much better. Meaning, there are situations where Edom, let's say, see a dead man, and they don't recognize him, but they say simanim, simanim in his body, simanim in his clothing, you know, various kinds of simanim. And the question is, are the witnesses believed? Witness or witnesses believed on the basis of those simanim, will we accept that to allow the woman whose dead husband it might be to remarry? And the Gemara makes clear that tvias ayin is much better than a siman. Right? Simanim can recur in different places, simanim can, you know, sometimes change. Tvias ayin, we, as human beings, especially when we look at other people, but in general, we have sort of a physical impression, we have a visual impression, then we have an image, and even if we can't describe it fully, we can't give enough, when you look, you say, that's it. And we do this all the time in terms of, you recognize a person. We recognize a person with tvias ayin. The Gemara says that tvias ayin is a very powerful force. The Gemara says, how is it that a man is permitted to cohabit with his wife at night? After all, he can't see her. Right? So the Gemara says, tvias ayin de kola. The tvias ayin of the voice. He recognizes the voice. In other words, the impressions, our complete picture of something or somebody is considered halachically a very, very powerful force. So in this case, the Hedyotos, Rabbi Gamliel could describe all he wanted. Well, was the moon was in this position, it was this high in the sky, you know, did the moon look like, you know, was it, what shape was the moon, was it a crescent? It's very hard, but if you show the witnesses, you know, exact images of the moon, the witness will say, that was what I saw. So he had these pictures on his wall. Very nice. V'omer lehem kazeri isim ha-kazeri isim. He would ask them, which did you see? And again, the assumption is, normally with the aid that they accepted, they weren't lying. They just might have not been able to describe what they saw properly. So now the Gemara asks a question. Umishari. Is it permissible? V'haksiv lo sasun iti. You shall not make iti, that which is with me, which means, lo sasun kidmush shamshai hamishamshim lefanai. You can't make that images of those who served before me. Now, Amar Abaye says the following: Lo asra Torah ela shamashim she'efshar lasos kamosan. Abaye says here. Now, this is very, very strange. As we read the Gemara, all that we shown him note the Gemara, the whole presentation of the Gemara is very odd of Abaye's statements. But first, the Gemara says, quotes Abaye saying, the Torah only prohibited making shamashim that you can actually make. Now, you can't make a sun or a moon or stars, and therefore there's no prohibition of making images of them. It's only prohibited to make something that you actually could make, and now the Gemara explains, which is, Kidetanya, lo yase adam bayis tavnis hechal, achsadra tavnis ulam, chotzer tavnis azara. You're not allowed to make, if you decide you're building your house, you're in real estate, and you build your own house, or so you're having somebody build your house, you're not allowed to build a house in the same proportions, in the same size, as the Beis HaMikdash, as the Heichal. If you're building an achsadra in front of a house, which is sort of a porched area, a portico, you're not allowed to build it in the same size of the ulam. In the Beis HaMikdash, what you had, you can see it here, thank you, Sam. Over here, this part, number 9 and 10, is the Heichal. The little thing that sticks out in front on each side, this hallway is called the ulam. I'll pass that around. Number 8 is the ulam. There's actually a machlokas that we showed him. I didn't know this until preparing the sugya. I always assumed the ulam is basically closed in. It's got a door at the front. It's a little wider than the door of the heichal. So it's a very long, narrow entranceway that you go into the heichal. But the Balei Tosfos claim that the ulam was open completely on the fourth side. In other words, you had the back wall, which adjoined the heichal. Okay, if you're looking at me, if I'm in the heichal here, you have a wall like this, you have short walls like this, and the front part was totally open, which is totally foreign to any picture you're ever going to see of it. It's a machlokas harishonim about this case of what was the nature of this of ulam. But we usually assume it was mostly closed in, but its doors were slightly wider than that of the heichal. So you're not allowed, if you're building an achsadra, you're not allowed to build it in the same shape, same dimensions as the ulam. If you're building a shulchan, you're not allowed to build it in the same shape as the shulchan and the mikdash. Presumably, you're normally not going to do that on your shulchan because the shulchan and the mikdash had things sticking up in the middle there, so it wouldn't be very convenient for seating. You're not allowed to make a menorah, tavnis menorah. This is the one that we all know, right? You're not allowed to make a menorah in the same shape, which is why we don't make seven candelabras, because that would be in the shape of the menorah and the mikdash. Avalu osa shel hei v'shelva v'shelches. But v'shel zayin lo yase afilu shoshar mine matrus. You cannot make it, even if you don't make it out of gold, even though normally the menorah and the beis hamikdash was made out of gold. However, you can't make it out of any metal. Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Huda Omer, av shel eitz lo yase, kiderech she'asu beis chashmonai. He claims, Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Huda claims, that in the time of the Chashmonaim, when the Greeks defiled everything, and they were poor initially, when they remade the menorah, they made it out of wood. The machlokas the Gemara Menachos explains here, which is not really relevant to us, is can you make a clay shares out of wood? And the Chachamim assume a clay shares does not always have to be made out of the material gold that the Torah describes, but it must be made out of metal. So the Chachamim say that you're only not allowed to make a menorah, seven branches, if it's made out of metal. Rabbi Yosef says even if it's made out of wood, Rabbi Yosef would only permit it if you made it out of cheres, out of pottery. Okay. Anyway, Amru lo misham raya, they said, what are you talking about? Shepudim shebarzel hayu v'chofim v'chafuyim bebatz. The Chachamim say they were actually rods, the inner rod was made of metal. They plated it with tin. Hashiru, when they became wealthier, Asam Shel Kesef, they remade the menorah out of silver. And when Chazru Veshiru Asam Shel Zav, so they remade it out of gold. All right, so putting that aside, the first statement the Gemara quotes is quoted from Abaye, saying the Torah only prohibited shamashim, which you can actually make. Okay? And therefore, now notice, by the way, these are not things that are bamaro. These are, the Braisa doesn't say that. It only says, so it's not just in the heavenly abodes, it's even in the earthly abodes. Or another way of looking at it is, as Chazal comment on the pasuk that we read yesterday, and we read every day in the Shira, Mikdash Hashem Konnu Yodecha, Machon L'Shiftecha Palat Hashem Mikdash Hashem Konnu Yodecha, is that the Mikdash Shamata is Mechuvan, Shamala is Mechuvan Keneged the Mikdash Shamata. The heavenly temple stands directly, you know, in correspondence to the earthly temple, so this is all part of the service of God. So you're not allowed, the things that are found in the Beis HaMikdash, you are not allowed to make them in the same proportions, the same dimensions. But the sun and the moon and the other heavenly bodies are not replicable, and therefore there's no prohibition of making them. That's the answer so far. So now the Gemara says, one second, V'shamashim she'i efshar, two lines from the bottom, she'i efshar lasos kemosan mishari, is that true? If you're not able to make them, it is permitted? V'hatanya, losasun iti, losasun kidmus shamashai hamishamshim lefanai bamorom, which are things by definition which you can't actually make. So Amar Abaye,
so that's the question.
It's a question on the previous answer, right? Because you can't say that the prohibition of losasun iti is limited to those things that are replicable by human hands. Because this brisa says, quoting the very same pasuk, but adding in one word to the drasha, is you can't even make shamashai hamishamshim lefanai bamorom.
So how do Rabbi Gamliel have those?
Right. So how could he make these things? So Amar Abaye says, lo asra Torah ela b'demus arba panim b'hadei hadadi. So Abaye says it's only prohibited to make the shamashim, hamishamshim b'marom, when you make the four images at the same time, the nesher, the aryeh, the adam, and the kruv. So the Gemara says, one second, you guys already know that this is wrong, because we saw this in the Brice already last week. But the Gemara says, Elamayata parts of Adam Lechude Tish. So before we read that, so the answer is that the prohibition right now, the Gemara says, of making Shamashim, which serve God in the heavens, is limited to the four faces of the Merkava, together, at once. You want to make a griffin vulture separately? That's fine. You want to make the image of a lion? That's fine. Image of a man? That's fine. Image of a crib? That's fine. Four together? No good.
But Rabbi Gamliel can make the moon.
Moon, because it's not one of those things. So now the Gemara says, one second. Is that really true? Elameata, parts of Adam l'chudei tishteri. It should be permissible to make the bust of a person, the image of a person. Alama Tanya, why do we have in the Brice that this was Rav Sheshes, a daf ago? Kol ha-partzufos mutarim chutzmi parts of Adam. And we said that it refers to the prohibition of making it, not keeping it. And the way we explained, at least initially, the way remember, it's Abaye who said that. And we're asking for Abaye right now, right? Rava ultimately said the prohibition was actually keeping it, not making it. But Abaye said the prohibition, yeah, it was making it, it was oseh. So how can Abaye say it's only prohibited to make the images of that which are found above if you make the four faces at the same time, namely a griffin, vulture, lion, person, cherub, when it's usher to make just the image of a person? So Amar Rav Huna Breid Rabbi Yoshua Mi Pirkei Rabbi Yoshua Shmieli. I heard a tradition in the name of Rabbi Yoshua, the following: Lo Sasun Iti, Lo Sasun. Read it as Osi, since it's missing a vav. The correct reading would be Iti, but nonetheless, read it instead as Osi Chaser Vav, which means you shouldn't make God. What does that mean? So we have a tradition that man, humankind, was created in the image of God. So therefore, making an image of a human being is prohibited because it's like making an image of God. Again, we don't think that God really looks like a person, but nonetheless, that is the idea here. So, of course, so apparently, then, you can't make the four faces together, and you can't make a single person alone, which you can sort of ask the question, well, of course you can't make the four faces together. Because to make the four faces together, you'd have to make a person. So the Mishonim asked that question. Some say that you would have thought, it might be that the prohibition of making a human face is only when you make it stand alone. But if you started, first you took an object, and you were going to engrave four faces on it. First you put a nesher, and then you put an aryeh, then maybe then you're allowed to put an adam. It's only an adam standalone. So adam standalone is prohibited, and it doesn't matter what, and these four faces together are prohibited as well. So you already stopped to ask yourself a question. What's going with Abaye? Right? Abaye keeps contradicting himself. Right? He keeps saying a new thing. And there's a very crucial word that Rishonim point out that's missing. We're only going to get through the Gemara today. We're not going to get to fully explore the answers till next week. But there's a crucial word that's missing each time the Gemara changes. The crucial word that's missing is the word Ella. Ella normally means when the Gemara has a question and it gives an answer, and then it has a question on the answer, it says Ella, it means it's changed direction. But the word Ella is absent in this case. It asks the next question, and then they quote Abaye. So firstly, Abaye seems to be contradicting possibly what he said earlier, or the way it's presented, and the Gemara never seems to back away from the earlier answers, which is what's very odd. Right, but we're not done yet. So now the Gemara says, Ushar Shamashim, outside of the four faces and parts of Adam, Mishari, are they really permitted? Vahatanya, lo sasun iti, lo sasun kidmus shamshai hamishamshim lefanai b'amara. You're not allowed to make anything like the images of those that serve before me in the heavens. Kigon, ofanei musrafim v'chayas hakodesh u'malachei hashareis. You can't make images of the angels, whatever exactly they look like. I don't know. That I'm not sure how you define, because what do angels exactly look like? Yes. I mean, I know there's a lot of art, you know, throughout, you know, Christian art, probably mostly Christian art, with the pictures of angels, but the pictures of angels are usually like people with wings. I don't really know what angels look like. Okay. But anyway, whatever they are, so that you're not allowed to make. So Amar Abaye...
So this is a question, how did Rabbi Gamliel make...
Right, so you see that it's not limited to the four partsufim together, or the parts of Adam. It applies even to other things that are serving. So how could Rabbi Gamliel make tablets with the moon with the moons on them? So Amar Abaye, lo asra Torah el shamashim shebimadar ha'elyon. So again, there's no Ella here. Abaye says the Torah only prohibits those that serve God in the upper abode, the Shebema, but not in the lower abode. And the heavenly luminaries are in the lower abode. So then the Gemara says, "V'shebemader atachton mishari." Are you allowed to make even those things that are in the lower abode? V'hatanya. Now, we quote a brisa, but look very carefully at the pasuk that's being quoted now. Up until now, it's been the same pasuk over and over. Lo sasun iti, which is at the end of Parshas Yisro, which refers really to the prohibition, the way Chazal say, of making things. Now they quote, asher bashamayim. Where is this from? It's from the Aseret HaDibros. Lo saseh lecho afesel kol tumunov. Chol tumunov asher b'shamayim imal, v'asher b'aretz mitachas, v'asher b'mayim mitachas l'aretz. Now, and then the next words are, lo sishtachav Elohem, v'lo sa'ovdein. So the question is, it says, you shall not make for yourself a graven image of that which is in the heavens above, of the earth below, of the water that is underneath the earth. You shall not bow down to them, you shall not worship them. So, v'atanya asher b'shamayim l'ramos chamao l'vano kochavim u'mazalos. Mima'al, the word mima'al, asher b'shamayim mima'al, after all, where are the heavens other than mima'al? So you interpret each word separately. So, mima'al l'ramos malach asheris. So you see what? That you're not allowed to make images even of the sun, the moon, and the stars. So the Gemara says, kitanya hi le'ovdam. No, that prohibition is only if you're making the image to worship it. Now, in context, you actually understand that, why they would say that, because the pasuk is from the Aseret HaDibros. So the Gemara says, if ilo ovdam, if that's what the Bryce is talking about, afilu shilshul katanami. You can't even make a little worm if your purpose is to worship it. Right? You're not allowed to make any image of anything if making a desire to worship is obviously prohibited. So the Gemara says, "Einachanami." You're right, and we say fidekarnafka. You learn it from the end of the pasuk. Detanya asher ba'aretz l'rabos yamu menaharos harem ugvaos and mitachas, because again, of course, the earth is below l'rabos shilshul katan. Okay, so that pasuk that prohibits making the sun, the moon, and the stars is only if your intent is to worship it. But if your intent is not to worship it, the only thing that's prohibited are the shamashim shebemadar ha'elyon, those servants, those that minister before God in the upper abode, and the image of something that you can actually make. You can't make a duplication of the stuff that's below, of the Beis HaMikdash, of the Ulam, of the Mizbeach, of the Menorah, of the Shulchan, whatever else. So then the Gemara says, whoa, va'asiyah gredasa mishari, is that really true? That just making it, just the making of the image is permitted? Of a sun, of moon, and the stars. V'atanya lo sasun iti lo sasun kidmos shamashai hamishamshin lefane b'amarom kigon. This version of the Brisa, it's almost like they're quoting the Brisa part by part, and each time they quote it, they quote a few more words from the Brisa. Kigon chama levana kochavim mazalos. So, what do you mean? In other words, and that's lo sasun iti. That's not the pasuk from the Aseret HaDibros. So that is a prohibition simply on making of the images. So now the Gemara is going to finally sort of answer these. Yeah, we don't understand what's going on with Abaye. Abaye, like, is Abaye constantly changing his mind? Why does the Gemara not suggest that Abaye is back yet? That Abaye not know the end of the Braisa? So let's hold off on that. Now the Gemara just says, Shani Rabban Gamliel da Achirim Asula. So Rabban Gamliel was different because someone else made it for him. The Achirim means a guy. A guy made it for him, and the prohibition is only on a Jew making it. Now, this is interesting in its own right. We're not going to talk about it today. Maybe we'll get to it next week or the following week. This should be a problem on Mira La'akum. So we know on Shabbos that you're not allowed to ask a guy in most cases to do malacha for you, barring certain circumstances. What about other situations? So the Rishonim already point out that it's not an issur that's limited to Shabbos. The Gemara Bava Metzia speaks about the prohibition of asking a guy to perform sirus. This is a complicated question. I think we've touched upon this before, about the neutering a pet. Is to ask even a non-Jewish veterinarian to ask him to do it for you is a problem of Amira La'akum. So Amira La'akum is not limited to Hilchos Shabbos. It seems to apply elsewhere. So the question is, why would Rabban Gamliel been allowed here? Of course, you could figure out the answer. I mean, one, you could figure out an answer. You could say, well, on Shabbos, it's permitted Letzorach Mitzvah sometimes. So you could say this was Letzorach Mitzvah also. Although it's not great public policy. So anyway, the Gemara says, though, Rabban Gamliel, others made it for Rabban Gamliel. He didn't make it. So it's not a problem. So now the Gemara says, V'ha Rabbi Yehuda, there's a tangent. V'ha Rabbi Yehuda da Chayrim Asula, V'amar Le Shmuel Rabbi Yehuda, Shinina Same Eine Dedain. So Rabbi Yehuda, apparently, Rabbi Yehuda, Shmuel's Talmud, had a ring. And the ring had on it an image, like an image of a person or something like that, and which he would stamp with. Now, it was, so the Gemara says, the Gemara says that that Shmuel told Rabbi Yehuda, he told Rabbi Yehuda, go smash the face of the of your seal. In other words, break some of it, break a little piece of it, give it a black eye or something like that. Why? So the assumption of the Gemara was is because you're so the assumption is Rabbi Yehuda didn't make this ring, and yet Shmuel was telling him you're not supposed to have this ring. So you see what? You see that Acheira making it for you doesn't make it permissible. So now the Gemara says no. Hasam b'chasam bolet. That was a case where the ring itself was, the image sort of stuck out. Umishum chashada. It was not because it was prohibited for somebody to make it for Rabbi Yehuda. It was because we were afraid that people would suspect that Rabbi Yehuda worshipped the ring. Why? Because it had an image that stood out. And then they quote a braisa at the Tanya. Tabasha chosama bolet, if you have a ring where the seal is sort of, in other words, you can have a seal that's either hollowed out, and when you stick in a material, it creates an object that stands comes off the page. Or, more typically, you have a ring which where the pieces sort of stick out, the image sticks out, and it makes an indentation. So the Gemara says that if the ring has sticks out, it's bolet, asur lahanicha, you're not allowed to wear it because of chashad, but umutur lachtomba. You're allowed to seal with it. Why? Because when you seal with it, you're not creating an image that sticks out, you're creating an image that sticks in, and that's not a problem. No, but you're not making an image. An image, what do you see from this Gemara? It sounds like for an image to be prohibited, what does it have to be? Well, it's got to be three-dimensional bolet. Right? Now, the Gemara doesn't talk about flat. It doesn't talk about, but it sounds like shokea, if it's sunk in when you make the image, that's fine. Bolate is a problem. And the assumption is bolate, people worship. Shokea, when it sticks in, people don't worship. So if you have a ring that's bolate, you can't wear it because people will suspect that you're worshiping it, but you've been chosen with it because you're making things that are shokea. However, if chosama shokea, if the ring itself is hollowed in, so it's not an image that stands out, mutar lanicha, you're allowed to wear it, but for asur lachtomba, but you're not allowed to make a seal with it, because when you seal with it, you wind up with a three-dimensional image sticking out. We're going to go over the details, God willing, next week to work out some of the very important issues here.
Are you wearing it to make the seal?
Well, you or some no, because sometimes, well, that's a question, whether or not you wear it for the seal, or you wear it also as a decorative issue.
I see.
As a decoration. This comes up in Shabbos, actually, the question of wearing rings. Wear your ring when you walk out into the Rosh Hashanah comes up in the Mishnah. So the Gemara said that the issue with Rabbi Yehuda had nothing to do with the prohibition of making it. There was no prohibition of making it or buying it because a non-Jew made it. The problem was of a Maris Ayin, that people would think Rabbi Yehuda was worshipping it. Rabban Gamliel, there was no concern about his worshipping this, at least at the moment. And now, so far. And then the Gemara says, the Gemara will ask the question later, why aren't you afraid from Gamliel that people would choshi that the Nasi was worshipping Avodah Zarah? But for right now, it has nothing to do with the prohibition of making it. So now the Gemara says, third wide line, Umichai Shinan L'chashada, are we really concerned about chashad when you see Jews who have three-dimensional images that you assume they worship it? V'ha Beiknishta D'Shafi Yosef Bin Arda is a very famous Beis HaKnesses. Legend had about this Beis HaKnesses that it was actually made by the first exiles, by Yehonya and his people from the first destruction of the first temple.
Shafi Yativ.
So Bin Arda, the Ukme Bey Andarta, somebody set up this Andarta, you know, this statue of the king or something. Shmuel's father and Levi, they used to enter the shul still, and they used to daven there. No one was afraid that they were worshipping the idol, the image, I should say. So the Gemara says, the answer is Rabbi Mishani. No, we're not, when you have a tzibur, we're not afraid that tzibur is worshipping others. Everybody knows. But an individual, a private individual who has some type of an image, a three-dimensional image, that would be typically worshipped, we are afraid of we are concerned for chashada, of what we would call Maris Ayin. So the Gemara says, yeah, but Bahar Rabban Gamliel, the Yachid who? Yachid Ava, Rabban Gamliel was an individual. You should treat him like Rabbi Yehuda, and you should have the same concern. Maybe he worships the images of the moon on his wall. So the Gemara says, Kevan the Nasi who Shchichi Rabim Gavei, because he was the Nasi, people were constantly visiting, and that's like Rabim. The Ebois Ema, another answer is the Prakim Have. Prakim means it was take apart. Rashi says it means he could take it apart, and he only put it together when he needed to ask the Edom, so there was no chashad, because it wasn't hanging on his wall. So he put the parts together when the witnesses came in, and he took it apart when they were done. And then the Gemara gives one final answer, which is really, really important. The Ebois Ema, Lehislamed Shani. No. It's different if you're doing it for the purposes of study. Ditanya, lo sumad la'asos, aval atalamed lahavin ulahoros. You're not allowed, the Torah, speaking about the prohibition of sorcery and witchcraft and all those things in Parsha Shoftim, it says, lo sumad la'asos, kiso avos hagayim ahem, lo yimotze v'cha mavir b'no uvito ba'esh, you shouldn't find someone amongst you who passes his children through the fire. Onein menachesh, I'm missing something. I say v'chover chover v'shoa over yidoni, I missed a couple there. You're not allowed to have these types of sorcery. So the Torah says, lo silmad la'asos. So the Gemara interprets, you're not allowed to study, to learn, in order to do it. Aval atalamed lahavin ulahoros. Which means literally to understand and to paskin. So Rabbi Gamliel, what's that?
You have over here, lefrakim have, but the Mishnah starts, mutzurot betavla bakotel. So...
But it was
the tabla v'kotel.
But it was a hanging tablet, and he took it down.
Here the frakim have, that was pieces.
Right.
So it's a contradiction.
But you would just say that he put it. He had put the pieces together. He's got one big thing that's now. It's like put a puzzle together. Yeah. Hangs it up on the wall. So now I'm gonna just raise a couple of questions about this, and then next week we're gonna try to sort of put many of the pieces together. Sorry, that was not intended. This is a very important statement in its own right. It suggests that the study of certain things is okay, or certain behaviors are okay, depending upon the intention. So I think about this, I have a personal stake in this. So my father, who was a retired physicist, so he published a book in the early 70s on solar energy. And so in that book, there are lots of pictures, you know, of the sun. The question is, assuming it's a machlokas harishonim that two-dimensional pictures of the heavenly luminaries are also prohibited, is such a thing permissible? So, I breathe a sigh of relief, which is, of course, that is lahavin ulahoros, that is lislamid. In other words, lahavin ulahoros the purpose is not for worship, it's not for aesthetics, it's not so you have a beautiful artwork, it's actually for the purposes of study. And that's what the Gemara says is permissible. So the question is, what are the parameters exactly of this idea of lahavin ulahoros? When we get to this, I don't know if it'll be next week or the following time that we meet, but this is actually a very, very important statement in terms of the issues of studying certain subjects outside of Torah, what this concept of lahavin ulahoros means. Okay.